Audible Frontiers presents Soldiers Live, written by Glenn Cook and narrated by Mark Vitor.
Chapter 1. An Abode of Ravens, When No Men Died. 4 years passed and no one died. Not of violence or hazard of the calling, anyway. Otto and Hagop did pass on within days of each other, of natural causes associated with aging, last year. A few weeks ago, one Tam Duk, recruit in training, perished of the overconfident exuberance of youth. He fell into a crevasse while he and his lance brothers were riding their blankets down the long, slick slope of the Tian Muen Glacier. There were a few others, but not a one by an unfriendly hand. 4 years has to be a record, though not the sort often recalled in these annals. That much peace is impossible to believe. Peace that prolonged becomes increasingly seductive. Many of us are old and tired and retain no youthful fire in the belly, but us old farts are not in charge anymore, and though we were prepared to forget horror, horror was not as accommodating toward us. In those days, the company was in service to its own name. We recognized no master. We counted the warlords of Xian as our allies. They feared us. We were supernatural, many recalled from the dead, the ultimate stone soldiers. They dreaded the chance that we might take sides in their squabbles over the bones of Xian, that once mighty empire the Nueng Bao recall as the land of unknown shadows. The more idealistic warlords have hopes of us. The mysterious File of Nine provide arms and money, and let us recruit because they hope we can be manipulated into helping them restore the golden age that existed before the Shadow Masters enslaved their world so cruelly that its people still call themselves the Children of the Dead. There is no chance we will participate, but we permit them the hope, the illusion. We have to get strong. We have a mission of our own. By standing still, we have caused the blossoming of a city. A once chaotic encampment has become ordered and has acquired names. Outpost or bridgehead among those who came from beyond the plain, and what translates as abode of ravens amongst the children of the dead. The place keeps growing. It has generated scores of permanent structures. It is in the process of acquiring a wall. The main street is being paved with cobblestones. Sleepy likes to keep everyone busy. She cannot stand a loafer. The children of the dead will inherit a treasure when we finally go away. Chapter 2. An Abode of Ravens, When the Bavas Sang. Boom, boom. Somebody hammered on my door. I glanced at Lady. She had stayed up late last night, and so had fallen asleep while studying this evening. She was determined to discover all the secrets of Xian magic, and to help Tobo harness the startlingly plentiful supernatural manifestations of this world. Not that Tobo needed much help any more. This world has more real phantoms and marvelous beings hiding in the bushes and behind the rocks and trees and on the edge of night than any 20 generations of our own frightened peasants could imagine. They gravitate toward Tobo as though he is some sort of nightside messiah, or amusing pet, maybe. Boom. Boom. I would have to get off my butt myself. That looked like a long, hard trek over there. Boom. Boom. Come on, Croaker, wake up! The door swung inward as my visitor invited himself inside. The very devil of my thoughts. Tobo. Didn't you hear the Bava singing? I heard a racket. Your friends are always kicking up a fuss about something. I don't pay attention anymore. When the Bava sing, it means somebody is going to die. And there's been a cold wind off the plain all day, and Big Ears and Goldeneye have been extremely nervous, and... It's One Eye, sir. I just went over to talk to him. He looks like he'd had another stroke. Shit. Let me get my bag. No surprise, One Eye suffering a stroke. That old fart has been trying to sneak out on us for years. Most of the vinegar went out of him back when we lost Goblin. Hurry! The kid loved that old shit-disturber. Sometimes it seemed like One Eye was what he wanted to be when he grew up. In fact, it seemed Tobo venerated everybody but his own mother, though the friction between them diminished as he aged. He had matured considerably since my latest resurrection. I'm hurrying as fast as I can, Your Grace. This old body doesn't have the spring it did in the olden days. Physician, heal thyself. Believe me, kid, I would if I could. If I had my druthers, I'd be 23 years old for the rest of my life, which would last another 3,000 years. That wind off the plain, it has Uncle worried, too. Doge is always worried about something. What does your father say? He and Mom are still at Kang Pi, visiting Master Santaraxita. At a tender 20, Tobo is already the most powerful sorcerer in all this world. Lady says he might possibly become a match for her in her prime. Scary. But he has parents he calls Mom and Dad still. He has friends he treats like people, not objects. He accords his teachers respect and honor instead of devouring them just to prove that he is stronger. His mother raised him well, despite having done so in the environment of the Black Company, and despite his innate rebellious streak. I hope he will remain a decent human being once he comes into his full powers. My wife does not believe that is possible. She is a pessimist about character. She insists that power corrupts, inevitably. She has only her own history by which to judge, and she sees only the dark side of everything. Even so, she remains one of Tobo's teachers, because, despite her bleak outlook, she retains the silly romantic streak that brought her here with me. I did not try to keep up with the boy. Time definitely has slowed me, and has left me with an ache for every one of the thousands of miles this battered old corpse has trudged, and it has equipped me with an old man's talent for straying off the subject. The boy never stopped chattering about the black hounds, fees, hobs, and hobbyas, and other creatures of the night that I have never seen. Which is all right. The few he has brought around have all been ugly, smelly, surly, and all too eager to copulate with humans of any sex or sexuality. The children of the dead claim that yielding is not a good idea. So far, discipline has held. The evening was chill. Both moons were up. Little boy was full. The sky was totally clear, except for a circling owl being pestered by what appeared to be a brace of night-flying rooks. One of those, in turn, had some smaller black bird skipping along behind it, darting in and out as it prosecuted reprisals for some corvine transgression, or just for the hell of it, the way my sister-in-law would do. Likely none of the flyers were actual birds. A huge something loomed beyond the nearest house. It made snorting noises and shuffled away. What I made out looked vaguely like the head of a giant duck. The earliest of the conquering Shadow Masters had possessed a bizarre turn of humor. This big, slow, goofy thing was a killer. Among the worst of the others were a giant beaver, a crocodile with 8 legs, and a pair of arms, and many variations of the themes of killer cattle, horses, and ponies, most of which spend their daytimes hiding underwater. The most bizarre beings were created by the nameless Shadow Master, now recalled as the First One, or the Master of Time. His raw material had consisted of shadows off the glittering plain, which in Xian are known as the Host of the Unforgiven Dead. It seems appropriate that Xian be called the Land of Unknown Shadows. A long feline roar ripped the night. That would be Big Ears or his sister, Catsith. By the time I reached One Eye's place, the black hounds had begun to vocalize, too. One Eye's house was scarcely a year old. The little wizard's friends raised it after they completed their own places. Before that, One Eye and his girlfriend, Tobo's grandmother, Gota, lived in an ugly, smelly little stick-and-mud hut. The new place was of mortared stone. It had a first-rate thatch roof above its four large rooms, one of which concealed a still. One Eye might be too old and feeble to weasel his way into the local black market, but I am sure he will continue distilling strong spirits till the moment his own spirit departs his wizened flesh. The man is dedicated. Gota kept the house spotless via the ancient device of bullying her daughter Sara into doing the housework. Gota, still called the troll by the old hands, was as feeble as One Eye. They were a matched pair in their passion for potent beverages. When One Eye gave up the ghost, he would be drawing a gill of the hard stuff for his honey. Tobo poked his head back outside. "Hurry up! Know who you're talking to, boy. The former military dictator of all the Taglias." The boy grinned, no more impressed than anyone else is these days. "Used to be is not worth the breeze on which it is scribbled." "I tend to philosophize about that, probably a little too much. Once upon a time, I was nothing and had no ambition to be anything more. Circumstance conspired to put immense power into my hands. I could have ripped the guts out of half a world had that been my inclination, but I let other obsessions drive me. So I am here on the far side of the circle, where I started, scraping wounds, setting bones, and scribbling histories nobody is likely to read. Only now I'm a lot older and crankier. I have buried all the friends of my youth, except One Eye. I ducked into the old wizard's house. The heat was ferocious. One Eye and Gota had trouble keeping warm even in summer, though summers in southern Xian seldom become hot. I stared. "You sure he's in trouble?" Tobo said, "He tried to tell me something. I didn't understand, so I came for you. I was afraid." Him, afraid. One Eye was seated in a rickety chair he had built for himself. He was motionless, but things stirred in the corners of the room, usually only visible at the edge of my eye. Snail shells cluttered the floor. Tobo's father, Mergen, calls them brownies after little folk recalled from his youth. There had to be 20 different races of them around, from no bigger than a thumb to half a man high. They really did do work when nobody was looking. That drove Sleepy crazy. It meant she had to work harder to think up chores to keep the company's villains out of trouble. An overpowering stench pervaded One Eye's house. It came from the mash for his still. The devil himself looked like a shrunken head the shrinker had not bothered to separate from its body. One Eye was a little bit of a thing. Even in his prime he had not been big. At 200-and-some years old, with both legs and most of one arm in the grave, he looked more like a shriveled monkey than a human being. I said, "I hear tell you're trying to get some attention again, old man." I knelt. One Eye opened. It focused on me. Time had been kind in that respect. His vision remained good. He opened his toothless mouth. At first nothing came out. He tried to raise a mahogany spider of a hand. He did not have the strength. Tobo shuffled his feet and muttered at the things in the corners. There are 10,000 strange things infesting Xian, and he knows every one by name, and they all worship him. For me, this intersection with the hidden world has been the most troubling development of our stay in the land of unknown shadows. I liked them better when they were still unknown. Outside, Stryker or Blackshuck or another blackhound began raising a racket. Others replied. The uproar moved southward, toward the Shadow Gate. I willed Tobo to go investigate. He stayed put, all questions and nags. He was about to become a major pain in the ass. "How's your grandmother?" I asked, preemptive strike. "Why don't you check?" Gota was not in the room. Usually she was, determinedly trying to do for One Eye, even though she had grown as feeble as he was. One Eye made a noise, moved his head, tried to raise that hand again. He saw the boy leave the room. His mouth opened. He managed to force out words in little bursts. "Croker, this is the last. She's done. I feel it
coming, finally.
I did not argue with him, did not question him. My error. We had been through similar scenes a half dozen times. His strokes were never quite fatal. It seemed fate had some last role for him in the grand design. Whatever, he had to work his way through his standard soliloquy. He had to warn me against hubris because he could not get it into his head that not only am I no longer the liberator, the military dictator of all the Taglias, I have abdicated claim to the captaincy of the Black Company. The captivity did not leave me rational enough for that task, nor had my understudy Mergen come through sufficiently unscathed. The burden now rests upon Sleepy's sturdy little shoulders. And One Eye had to ask me to look out for Gota and Tobo. Over and over he would remind me to watch out for Goblin's wicked tricks, even though we had lost Goblin years ago. I suspect that should there be any afterlife at all, those two will meet up about 6 seconds after One Eye croaks, and they will pick up their feud right where they left it in life. In fact, I'm a little surprised Goblin has not been around haunting One Eye. He threatened to often enough. Maybe Goblin just cannot find him. Some of the Nuang Bao say they feel lost because the shades of their ancestors cannot find them to watch over them and give advice inside their dreams. Kina cannot find us either, apparently. Lady has not had a bad dream in years. Or maybe Goblin killed her. One Eye beckoned with one desiccated finger. Closer. Kneeling in front of him, opening my kit, I was about as close as I could get. I took his wrist. His pulse was weak and rapid and irregular. I did not get the impression that he had suffered a stroke. He murmured, "I am not a fool who doesn't know when he is and what has happened. You listen, you watch out for Goblin, little girl, and Tobo. Didn't see him dead, left him with Mother of Deceit." Shit, that never occurred to me. I was not there. I was still one of the captured when Goblin stuck the sleeping goddess with the standard. Only Tobo and Sleepy had witnessed that, and anything they knew had to be suspect. Kina was the queen of deceivers. "A good idea, old man. Now, what do I have to do to get you to get up and fetch me a drink?" Then I started as something that looked like a small black rabbit peeked at me from under One Eye's chair. This was a new one. I could call Tobo. He would know what it was. There are uncounted varieties of the things, huge and small, some gentle, and many definitely not. They just gravitate toward Tobo. In only a few cases, generally involving the most disagreeable sorts, he has taken Lady's advice and bound them to his personal service. The children of the dead worry about Tobo. Having suffered a few hundred years under the heels of the Shadow Masters, they are paranoid about outsider sorcerers. So far the warlords have remained reasonable. None of them want to spark the ire of the soldiers of darkness. That might cause the company to align itself with a rival. Status quo and balance of force are cherished and jealously nurtured by the File of Nine. Terrible chaos followed the expulsion of the last Shadow Master. None of the warlords want the chaos to return, though what Xian has now resembles nothing so much as lightly organized anarchy. But not a one is willing to yield a minimum of power to another authority either. One Eye grinned, revealing dark gums.
"Not going to trick me, Captain."
"I'm not the captain anymore. I'm retired. I'm just an old man who pushes paper as an excuse to keep hanging around with the living. Sleepy is the boss."
"Still, management."
"I'm about to manage your scruffy old ass." I trailed off. His eye had closed. He made a statement by beginning to snore. Another hoot and holler arose outside, some close by, more far away, toward the Shadow Gate. The snail shells creaked and rustled, and, though I never saw a one touched by anything, rocked and spun around. Then I heard the distant bray of a horn. I rose and retreated, not turning my back. One Eye's lone remaining pleasure, other than staying drunk, was tripping the unwary with his cane. Tobo reappeared. He looked ghastly.
Captain, Croker, sir, I misunderstood what he tried to tell me.
What?
It wasn't him. It was Nana Gota.
Chapter 3. An Abode of Ravens. A Labor of Love. Tobo's grandmother, Ki Gota, had died happy. As happy as the troll could die, which was drunker than three owls drowned in a wine cask. She had enjoyed a vast quantity of extremely high-potency product before she went. I told the boy, if it's any consolation, she probably didn't know a thing, although the evidence suggested she knew exactly what was happening. I did not fool him. She knew it was coming. The Graylings were here. Something behind the still chittered softly in response to the sound of his voice. Like the Bavas, the Graylings are a harbinger of death, one of a great many in Sien. Some of the things that had been howling in the wilderness earlier would have been, too. I said the things you say to the young. It was probably a blessing. She was in constant pain, and there was nothing I could do for her anymore. The old woman's body had been a torment to her for as long as I had known her. Her last few years had been hell. For a moment, Tobo looked like a sad little boy who wanted to bury his face in his mother's skirt and shed some tears. Then he was a young man whose control was complete again. She did live a long life and a fulfilled one, no matter how much she complained. The family owes One Eye for that. Complain she had, often and loudly, to everyone about everything and everyone else. I had been fortunate enough to miss much of the Gota era by having gotten myself buried alive for a decade and a half. Such a clever man am I. Speaking of family, you'll have to find Doge, and you'd better send word to your mother. And as soon as you can, you'll need to let us know about funeral arrangements. Nguyen Bao funerary customs seem almost whimsical. Sometimes they bury their dead, sometimes they burn them, sometimes they wrap them and hang them in trees. The rules are unclear. Doge will make the arrangements. I'm sure the community will demand something traditional, in which case my place is somewhere out of the way. The community consists of those Nguyen Bao associated with the Black Company, who have not enlisted formally and who have not yet disappeared into the mysterious reaches of the Land of Unknown Shadows. No doubt. The community are proud of Tobo, but custom demands that they look down on him for his mixed blood and lack of respect for tradition. Others will need to know, too. This will be a time of great ceremony. Your grandmother is the first female from our world to pass away over here, unless you count the White Crow. Old Gota seemed much less formidable in death. Tobo's thoughts were moving obliquely to mine. There'll be another crow, Captain. There'll always be another crow. They feel at home around the Black Company, which is why the children of the dead call our town the Abode of Ravens. There are always crows, real or unknown. They used to stay fat. The unknown shadows were all around us now. I could see them easily myself, though seldom clearly and seldom for more than an instant. Moments of intense emotion draw them out of the shells where Tobo taught them to hide. A renewed racket arose outside. The little darknesses stirred excitedly, then scattered, somehow disappearing without ever revealing what they were. Tobo said, "The Dreamwalkers must be hanging around on the other side of the Shadow Gate again." I did not think so. This evening's racket was different. An articulate cry came from the room where we had left One Eye, so the old man had been faking his snooze after all. I'd better see what he wants. You get Doge.
You don't believe it.
The old man was agitated now. He was angry enough to speak clearly, without much huffing and puffing. He threw up a hand, one wrinkled, twisted, ebony digit pointed at something only he could see.
The doom is coming, Croker. Soon. Maybe even tonight.
Something outside howled as if to strengthen his argument, but he did not hear it. The hand fell. It rested for several seconds, then it rose again, one digit indicating an ornate black spear resting on pegs above the doorway.
It's done.
He had been crafting that death tool for a generation. Its magical power was strong enough for me to sense whenever I considered it directly. Normally I am deaf, dumb, and blind in that area. I married my own personal consultant.
You run into Goblin. Give him the spear.
I should just hand it over.
My hat, too.
One eye showed me a toothless grin. For the entirety of my time with the company, he had worn the biggest, ugliest, dirtiest, most disreputable black felt hat imaginable.
But you got to do it right.
So, he still had one practical joke to pull, even though it would be on a dead man, and he would be dead himself long before it could happen. There was a scratch at the door. Someone entered without waiting invitation. I looked up. Doge, the old swordmaster and priest of the Nyoingbao community, associated with the company but not of it for 25 years now. I do not entirely trust him, even after so long. I seem to be the only doubter left, though. Doge said,
"The boy said Gota,"
I gestured, back there. He nodded understanding. I would focus on one eye, because I could do nothing for the dead, nor all that much for one eye, I feared. Doge asked,
"Where is Taide?"
"At Kangpi, I assume, with Mergen and Sara." He grunted,
"I'll send someone."
"Let Tobo send some of his pets. That would get some of them out from underfoot, and have the additional consequence of reminding the File of Nine, the Master Council of Warlords, that the stone soldiers enjoy unusual resources, if they could detect those entities at all." Doge paused at the doorway to the back.
"There's something wrong with those things tonight. They're like monkeys when there's a leopard on the prowl."
"Monkeys we know well. The rock apes haunting the ruins lying where Kialune stands in our own world are as pesky and numerous as a plague of locusts. They are smart enough and deft enough to get into anything not locked up magically, and they are fearless. And Tobo is too soft of heart to employ his supernatural friends in a swift educational strike." Doge vanished through the doorway. He remained spry, although he was older than Gota. He still ran through his fencing rituals every morning. I knew by direct observation that he could defeat all but a handful of his disciples using practice swords. I suspect the handful would be surprised unpleasantly if the duel ever involved real steel. Tobo is the only one as talented as Doge, but Tobo can do anything, always with grace and usually with ridiculous ease. Tobo is the child we all think we deserve. I chuckled. One eye murmured,
"What?"
"Just thinking how my baby grew up."
"That's funny."
"Like a broken broom handle pounded up the shit chute."
"You should learn to appreciate cosmic practical jokes."
The cosmos was spared my rancor. The street door opened to someone even less formal than Uncle Doge. Willow Swan invited himself inside.
"Shut it quick," I snapped.
"That moonlight shining off the top of your head is blinding me." I could not resist. I recalled him when he was a young man with beautiful long blonde hair, a pretty face, and a poorly disguised lust for my woman. Swan said,
"Sleepy sent me. There are rumors."
"Stay with One Eye. I'll deliver the news myself." Swan bent forward.
"He breathing?"
With his eyes shut, One Eye looked dead, which meant he was laying back in the weeds hoping to get somebody with his cane. He would remain a vicious little shit till the moment he did stop breathing. "He's fine, for now. Just stay with him, and holler if anything changes." I put my things back in my bag. My knees creaked as I rose. I could not manage that without putting some of my weight on One Eye's chair.
The gods are cruel. They should let the flesh age at the rate the spirit does. Sure, some people would die of old age in a week, but the keepers would hang around forever, and I would not have all these aches and pains, either way. I limped as I left One Eye's house. My feet hurt. Things scurried everywhere but where I was looking. Moonlight did not help a bit. Chapter 4 The Grove of Doom. Night Songs. The drums had begun at sunset, softly, a dark, whispering promise of a shadow of all night falling. Now they roared boldly. True night had come. There was not even a sliver of moon. The flickering light of 100 fires set shadows dancing. It appeared that the trees had pulled up their roots to participate. 100 frenzied disciples of the Mother of Night capered with them, their passion building. 100 bound prisoners shivered and wept and fouled themselves, fear unmanning some who had believed themselves heroic. Their pleas fell upon unhearing ears. A looming darkness emerged from the night, dragged by prisoners straining at cables in the hopeless hope that by pleasing their captors they might yet survive. 20 feet tall, the shape proved to be a statue of a woman, as black and glistening as polished ebony. It had 4 arms. It had rubies for eyes and crystal fangs for teeth. It wore a necklace of skulls. It wore another necklace of severed penises. Each taloned hand clutched a symbol of her power over humanity. The prisoners saw only the noose. The beat of the drums grew more swift. Their volume rose. The children of Kina began to sing a dark hymn. Those prisoners who were devout began to pray to their own favored gods. A skinny old man watched from the steps of the temple at the heart of the Grove of Doom. He was seated. He no longer stood unless he had to. His right leg had been broken and the bone improperly set. Walking was difficult and painful. Even standing was a chore. A tangle of scaffolding rose behind him. The temple was undergoing restoration. Again. Standing over him, unable to remain still, was a beautiful young woman. The old man feared her excitement was sensual, almost sexual. That should not be. She was the daughter of night. She did not exist to serve her own senses.
"I feel it, Narayan," she enthused. "The imminence is there. This is going to reconnect me with my mother."
"Perhaps." The old man was not convinced. There had been no connection with the goddess for 4 years. He was troubled. His faith was being tested again. And this child had grown up far too headstrong and independent.
"Or it may just bring the wrath of the Protector down on our heads."
He went no farther. The argument had been running from the moment that she had used some of her raw, completely untrained magical talent to blind their keepers for the moments they had needed to escape the Protector's custody 3 years ago. The girl's face hardened. For a moment it took on the dread implacability apparent on the face of the idol. As she always did when the matter of the Protector came up, she said,
"She'll regret mistreating us, Narayan. Her punishment won't be forgotten for 1,000 years.
Narayan had grown old being persecuted. It was the natural order of his existence. He sought always to make sure that his cult survived the wrath of its enemies. The daughter of night was young and powerful and possessed all of youth's impetuosity and disbelief in its own mortality. She was the child of a goddess. That goddess's ruling age was about to break upon the world, changing everything. In the new order, the daughter of night would herself become a goddess. What reason had she to fear? That madwoman in Taglios was nothing. Invincibility and caution, they were forever at loggerheads, yet were forever inseparable. The daughter of night did believe, with all her heart and soul, that she was the spiritual child of a goddess. She had to. But she had been born of man and woman.
A flake of humanity remained as a stain upon her heart. She had to have somebody. Her movements became more pronounced and more sensual, less controlled. Narayan grimaced. She must not forge an interior connection between pleasure and death. The goddess was a destroyer in one avatar, but lives taken in her name were not taken for reasons so slight. Kina would not countenance her daughter yielding to hedonism. If she did, there would be punishments, no doubt falling heaviest upon Narayan Singh. The priests were ready. They dragged weeping prisoners forward to fulfill the crowning purpose of their lives, their parts in the rites that would reconsecrate Kina's temple. The second rite would strive to contact the goddess, who lay bound in enchanted sleep, so that once again the daughter of night would be blessed with the Dark Mother's wisdom and far-seeing vision. All things that needed doing. But Narayan Singh, the living saint of the deceivers, the great hero of the Strangler cult, was not a happy man. Control had drifted too far away. The girl had begun altering the cult to reflect her own inner landscape. He feared the chance that one of their arguments would not heal afterward. That had happened with his real children. He had sworn an oath to Kina that he would bring the girl upright, that they both would see her bring on the Year of the Skulls. But if she continued growing ever more headstrong and self-serving... She could restrain herself no longer. She hurried down the steps. She plucked a strangling scarf from the hands of one of the priests. What Narayan saw in the girl's face then he had seen only one place before, in his wife's face, in her passion, so long ago that it seemed to have happened during an earlier turn around the wheel of life. Saddened, he realized that when the next rite started, she would throw herself into the torture of the victims. In her state, she might become too involved and spill their blood, which would be an offense the goddess would never excuse. He was becoming extremely troubled, was Narayan Singh. And then he became more troubled still, as his wandering eye caught sight of a crow in the crotch of a tree, almost directly behind the deadly rite. Worse, that crow noticed him noticing it. It flung itself into the air with a mocking cry. 100 crow voices immediately answered from all over the grove. The protector knew. Narayan yelled at the girl. Attention much too focused, she did not hear him. Agony ripped through his leg as he climbed to his feet. How soon would the soldiers arrive? How would he ever run again? How would he keep the goddess's hope alive when his flesh had grown so frail and his faith had worn so threadbare? Chapter 5. An Abode of Ravens. Headquarters. Outpost was a quiet city of broad lanes and white walls. We had adopted the native custom of whitewashing everything but the thatch and decorative vegetation. On holidays, some locals even painted each other white. White had been a great symbol of resistance to the Shadow Masters in times gone by. Our city was artificial and military, all straight lines, cleanliness, and quiet. Except at night, if Tobo's friends got to brawling amongst themselves. By day, noise was confined to the training fields, where the latest bunch of native would-be adventurers were learning the Black Company way of doing business. I was remote from all that, except for patching up training mishaps. No one from my era was involved anymore. Like One Eye, I am a relic of a distant age, a living icon of the history that makes up so much of the unique social adhesive we use to hold the company together. They rolled me out on special occasions and had me give sermons that began, "In those days the company was in service to..." It was a spooky night, the two moons illuminating everything while casting conflicting shadows, and Tobo's pets were increasingly disturbed about something. I began to catch straightforward glimpses of some when they became too distracted to work at staying out of sight. In most cases, I was sorry. The uproar up toward the Shadow Gate rose and fell. There were lights up there now, too,
A couple of fireballs flew just before I reached my destination. I began to feel uneasy myself. Headquarters was a two-story sprawl at the center of town. Sleepy had filled it with assistants and associates and functionaries who kept track of every horseshoe nail and every grain of rice. She had turned command into a bureaucratic exercise, and I did not like it, of course, because I was a cranky old man who remembered how things used to be in the good old days when we did things the right way, my way. I do not think I have lost my sense of humor, though. I see the irony in having turned into my own grandfather. I have stepped aside. I have passed the torch to someone younger, more energetic and tactically brighter than I ever was. But I have not abandoned my right to be involved, to contribute, to criticize, and particularly to complain. It is a job somebody has to do, so I exasperate the younger people sometimes, which is good for them. It builds character. I strode through the ground floor busy work Sleepy uses to shield herself from the world. Day or night, there was a crew on duty, counting those arrowheads and grains of rice. I should remind her to get out into the world once in a while. Putting up barriers will not protect her from her demons, because they are all inside her already. I was almost old enough to get away with talk like that. Irritation crossed her dry, dusky, almost sexless face when I walked in. She was at her prayers. I do not understand that. Despite everything she has been through, much of which puts the lie to Vedna doctrine, she persists in her faith. I'll wait till you're done. The fact that I had caught her was what irritated her. The fact that she needed to believe even in the face of the evidence was what embarrassed her. She rose, folded her prayer rug.
How bad is he this time?
Rumor got it wrong. It wasn't One Eye. It was Gota, and she's gone. But One Eye is in a pickle about something else he thinks is going to happen, about which he was less than vague. Tobo's friends are being more than normally weird, so it's entirely possible it isn't One Eye's imagination.
I'd better send someone after Sara.
Tobo is taking care of it. Sleepy considered me steadily. She may be short, but she has presence and self-confidence.
What's on your mind?
I'm feeling some of what One Eye is, or maybe I just naturally can't stand a prolonged peace.
Lady nagging you about going home again?
No. Mergen's last communion with Shivetya has her worried, to say the least. Modern history had turned cruel back in our home world. The deceiver cult has rebounded in our absence, making converts by the hundred. At the same time, Soulcatcher tormented the Taglian territories in a mad and mainly fruitless effort to root out her enemies, most of whom were imaginary until she and Mogaba created them through their zeal. She hasn't said so, but I'm pretty sure she's afraid Boo Boo is manipulating Soulcatcher somehow. Sleepy could not stifle a smile.
Boo Boo?
Your fault. I picked it up from something you wrote.
She's your daughter.
We have to call her something.
I can't believe you two never picked a name.
She was born before... I like Channa. It was good enough for my grandmother. Lady would have demurred. It sounded too much like Kina. And although Boo Boo might be a nightmare stalking, Boo Boo was Lady's daughter. And in the land where she had grown up, mothers always named the daughters. Always. When the time was right. This time will never be right. This child denies us both. She stipulates that our flesh quickened her flesh, but she is animated by an absolute conviction that she is the spiritual daughter of the goddess Kina. She is the daughter of night. Her sole purpose for existing is to precipitate the Year of the Skulls. That great human disaster that will free her slumbering soul mother so she can resume working her wickedness upon the world. Or upon the worlds, actually, as we had discovered once my quest for the company's ancient origins had led us to the time-racked fortress on the plain of glittering stone, lying between our world and the land of unknown shadows.
Silence stretched between us. Sleepy had been analyst a long time. She had come to the company young. Its traditions meant a great deal to her. Consequently, she remained unfailingly courteous to her predecessors. But internally, I am sure she was impatient with us old farts, particularly with me. She never knew me well, and I was always taking up time wanting to know what was going on. I have begun putting too much emphasis on detail now that I do not have much to do but write. I told her, "I don't offer advice unless you ask." That startled her. "Trick I learned from Soul Catcher makes people think you're reading their minds. She's much better at it." "I'm sure she is. She's had all that time to practice." She puffed air out of expanded cheeks. "It's been a week since we've talked. Let's see. Nothing to report from Shivetya. Mergen's been at Kang Pi with Sara, so he hasn't been in touch with the golem. Reports from the men working on the plane say they're suffering from recurring premonitions of disaster."
"Really? They said it that way?" She had her pontifical moments.
"Roughly."
"What's the traffic situation?"
"There is none."
She looked puzzled. The plane had seen no one cross for generations before the company managed the passage. The last, before us, had been the Shadow Masters who had fled the Land of Unknown Shadows for our world back before I was born.
"Wrong question, I guess. How are you coming with preparations for our return?" "That a personal or professional question?"
Everything was business with Sleepy. I do not recall ever having seen her relax. Sometimes that worried me. Something in her past, hinted at in her own annals, had left her convinced that that was the only way she could be safe.
"Both. I wished I could tell Lady that we would be going home soon. She had no love for the Land of Unknown Shadows. I am sure she will not enjoy the future wherever we go. It is an absolute certainty that the times to come will not be good. I do not believe she understands that yet. Not in her heart. Even she can be naive about some things."
"The short answer is that we can probably put a reinforced company across as early as next month, if we can acquire the Shadowgate knowledge."
"Crossing the plain is a major undertaking because you have to carry with you everything you will need for a week. Up there, there is nothing to eat but glittering stone. Stone remembers, but stone has little nutritional value."
"Are you going too?"
"I'm going to send scouts and spies, no matter what. We can use the home Shadow Gate as long as we only put through a few men at a time."
"You won't take Shivetya's word?"
"The demon has his own agenda."
She would know. She had been in direct communion with that steadfast guardian.
What I knew of the golem's designs made me concerned for Lady. Shivetya, that ancient entity, created to manage and watch over the plane, which was an artifact itself, wanted to die. He could not do so while Kina survived. One of his tasks was to ensure that the sleeping goddess did not awaken and escape her imprisonment. When Kina ceased to exist, my wife's tenuous grasp on those magical powers critical to her sense of self-worth and identity would perish with her. What powers Lady boasted, she possessed only because she had found a way to steal from the goddess. She was a complete parasite. I said, "And you, believing the company dictum that we have no friends outside, don't value his friendship."
"Oh, he's perfectly marvelous, Croker. He saved my life. But he didn't do it because I'm cute and I jiggle in the right places when I run."
She was not cute. I could not imagine her jiggling, either. This was a woman who had gotten away with pretending to be a boy for years. There was nothing feminine about her, nor anything masculine, either. She was not a sexual being at all, though for a while there had been rumors that she and Swan had become a midnight item. It turned out purely platonic.
"I'll reserve comment. You've surprised me before."
"Captain!"
Took her a while sometimes to understand when someone was joking, or even being sarcastic, though she had a tongue like a razor herself.
She realized I was ribbing her.
I see. Then let me surprise you one more time by asking your advice.
Uh-oh. You'll have them sharpening their skates in hell.
Howler and Long Shadow, I've got to make decisions.
File of Nine nagging you again. The File of Nine. File, from military usage, was a council of warlords, their identities kept secret, who formed the nearest thing to a real ruling body in Xian. The monarchy and aristocracy of record were little more than decorative, and in the main, too intimate with poverty to accomplish much if the inclination existed. The File of Nine had only limited power. Their existence barely assured that near anarchy did not devolve into complete chaos. The Nine would have been more effective had they not prized their anonymity more than their implied power.
Them and the Court of All Seasons. The noble judges really want Long Shadow.
The Imperial Court of Xian, consisting of aristocrats with less real-world power than the File of Nine, but enjoying more a demonstrative moral authority, were obsessively interested in gaining possession of Long Shadow. Being an old cynic, I tended to suspect them of less than moral ambitions, but we had few dealings with them. Their seat, Quang Nin City, was much too far away. The one thing the peoples of Xian held in common, every noble and every peasant, every priest and every warlord, was an implacable and ugly thirst for revenge upon the Shadow Master invaders of yesteryear. Long Shadow, still trapped in stasis underneath the glittering plain, represented the last possible opportunity to extract that cathartic vengeance. Long Shadow's value in our dealings with the Children of the Dead was phenomenally disproportionate. Hatreds seldom are constrained to rational scales. Sleepy continued.
And hardly a day goes by that I don't hear from some lesser warlord begging me to bring Long Shadow in. The way they all volunteer to take charge of him leaves me nurturing the sneaking suspicion that most of them aren't quite as idealistically motivated as the File of Nine and the Court of All Seasons.
No doubt. He'd be a handy tool for anybody who wanted to adjust the power balance, if anyone was fool enough to believe he could manage a puppet Shadow Master. No world lacks its villains so self-confident that they don't believe they can get the best end of a bargain with darkness. I married one of those. I'm not sure she has learned her lesson yet. Has anyone offered to fix our Shadow Gate?
The court is actually willing to give us someone. The trouble with that is that they don't actually have anyone equipped with the skills to make the needed fixes. Chances are no one has those skills, but the knowledge exists in records stored in Kang Pi.
So why don't we...
We're working on it. Meantime, the court do seem to believe in us, and they absolutely do want some kind of revenge before all of Long Shadow's surviving victims have been claimed by age.
And what about the Howler?
Tobo wants him. Says he can handle him now.
Does anybody else think so? I meant Lady. Or is he overconfident? Sleepy shrugged.
There's nobody telling me they've got anything more they can teach him.
She meant Lady, too, and did not mean that Tobo suffered from a teen attitude. Tobo had no trouble taking advice or instruction when either of those did not originate with his mother. I asked anyway. Not even Lady.
She, I think, might be holding out on him.
You can bet on it. I married the woman, but I don't have many illusions about her. She would be thrilled to go back to her old wicked ways. Life with me and the company has not been anything like happily ever after. Reality has a way of slow-roasting romance, though we get along well enough.
She can't be any other way. Get her to tell you about her first husband. You'll marvel that she came out as sane as she did.
I marveled every day, right before I gave in to my astonishment that the woman really had given up everything to ride off with me. Well, something. She had not had that much at the time, and her prospects had been grim.
What the hell is that?
Alarm horns. Sleepy bolted out of her seat. She was spry for a woman treading hard on the heels of middle age. On the other hand, of course, she was so short she did not have a lot of real getting up to do. I didn't order any drills. She had an ugly habit of doing that. Only the traitor Mogaba, when he had been with us, had had as determined an attitude about preparedness. Sleepy was too serious about everything. Tobo's unknown shadows began raising their biggest uproar yet. Come on, Sleepy snapped. Why aren't you armed? She was. She always was, although I never have seen her use a weapon more substantial than guile. I'm retired. I'm a paper pusher these days. I don't see you wearing a tombstone for a hat. I had an attitude problem once upon a time, myself, but speaking of which, I want a reading in the officer's mess before lights out, something that tells us all about the wages of indolence and the neglect of readiness, or about the fate of ordinary mercenaries. She was in brisk motion, headed for the main exit, overtaking staffers who were not dawdling themselves. Make a hole, people! Make a hole! Coming through! Outside, people were pointing and babbling. The moonlight and a lot of fire betrayed a pillar of black, oily smoke boiling up from just below the gate to the glittering plain. I stated the obvious. Something's happened. Clever me. Sovereign's up there. He has a level head. Sovereign was a solid young officer with maybe just a tad of worship for his captain. You could be confident that neither accidents nor stupid mistakes would happen on Sovereign's watch. Runners gathered, ready to carry Sleepy's instructions. She gave the only order she could till we knew more. Be alert. Even though, to a man, we believed that there was no way major trouble could come at us from off the plane. The thing that you know to be true is the lie that will kill you. Chapter 6 An Abode of Ravens. Sovereign's News. Sovereign did not arrive until after midnight. By then, even our dullards understood that there was significance to the agitation of the hidden folk and the crows whose presence gave our settlement its local name. Arms had been issued, men with fireball poles now perched on every rooftop. Tobo had warned his supernatural friends to stay out of town, lest taut human nerves snap and cause them harm. Everyone of stature available gathered to await Sovereign's report. A couple of subalterns took turns running up to the headquarters roof to check the progress of the torches descending the long scarp from the Shadow Gate. Local boys, they seemed to feel that their great adventure had begun at last. They were fooled. An adventure is somebody else slogging through the mud and snow while suffering from trench foot, ringworm, dysentery, and starvation, being chased by people with their hearts set on murder or more. I have been there. I have done that, playing both parts. I do not recommend it. Be content with a nice farm or shop. Make lots of babies and bring them up to be good people. If the new blood remain blind to reality after we move out, I guarantee that their naivete will not long survive their first encounter with my sister-in-law, Soul Catcher. Sovereign finally arrived, accompanied by the runner Sleepy had sent to meet him. He seemed surprised by the size of the assembly awaiting him. Get up front and talk, Sleepy told him. Always direct and to the point, my successor. Silence fell. Sovereign looked around nervously. He was short, dark, slightly pudgy. His family had been minor nobility. Sleepy had taken him prisoner of war 4 years ago, just before the company climbed onto the glittering plain, headed this way. Now he commanded an infantry battalion and seemed destined for bigger things because the company was growing. He told us, "Something came through the Shadow Gate." Jabber, jabber, question, question. I don't know what. One of my men came to tell me he thought he'd seen something sneaking around in the rocks on the other side of the gate. I went to look. After 4 years of nothing happening, I assumed it would be just a shadow or one of the Neph. The Dreamwalkers visit us all the time. I was wrong.
I never got a good look at the thing, but it seemed to be a large animal, black and extremely fast. Not as big as Big Ears or Catsith, but definitely faster. It was able to pass through the Shadow Gate without help. I felt a chill. I tried to reject my immediate suspicion. It was not possible. Nevertheless, I said, "For Valaka."
"Tobo, where are you?"
Sleepy demanded.
"Here."
He sat with several children of the dead, officers in training.
"Find this thing. Catch it. If it's what Croker said, I want you to kill it."
"That'll be easier said than done. It's already squabbled with the Black Hounds. They backed off. They're just trying to keep track of it now."
"Then kill it, Tobo."
There was no "try to" or "do whatever you can" with this captain. I told him, "Ask Lady to help you. She knows those things. But before anybody does anything, we need to set up some kind of protection for One Eye. If it was a shape-shifting, man-eating werepanther from our homeworld, it could be only one monster, and that creature hated One Eye with the deepest and most abiding passion imaginable, because One Eye had slain the only wizard capable of helping it regain its human form."
"You think it really is Lisa Bowalk?" Sleepy asked.
"I get that feeling. But you told me it escaped from the plane through the Katavar Gate, and it couldn't get back." Sleepy shrugged.
"That's what Shivetya showed me. It's possible that I just assumed it couldn't get back onto the plane."
"Or maybe it made new friends out there." The little woman spun, barked.
"Sovereign?"
Sovereign understood.
"I left them on maximum alert."
I said, "Tobo will have to check the seals on the gate. We don't want it leaking shadows, because whatever it was broke through." Though the boy would not be able to do much to stem a real flood, that honor would have to go to his hidden folk friends. Lack of technical knowledge about shadow gates was the main reason we continued to reside in the land of unknown shadows.
"I understand that, Croker. Can I get to work here?"
I was underfoot. Being considered useless is irksome. That condition was familiar to most of us whom Soulcatcher had beguiled and captured and managed to leave buried for 15 years. Our company had changed during our slumber. Even Lady and Mergen, who had maintained tenuous connections with the outside world, found themselves marginalized now. Mergen did not mind. The culture of the company has become quite alien. Almost no northern flavor remains. Just a few little quirks in how things are done, and my own proud legacy, an interest in hygiene that is completely foreign to these climes. These southerners did not enjoy a proper terror of the For Valaka. They insisted on picturing it as just another spooky night stalker like Big Ears or Paddlefoot, which they consider essentially harmless. Near as I can tell, they appear harmless only because their victims seldom survive to report any contrary facts. "A reading from the first book of Croker," I told the assembly. It was after midnight. There had been no uproar for a while. The Shadow Gate was not leaking the unforgiven dead. Tobo was trying to pinpoint the intruder, but was having difficulties. It was moving around a lot, scouting, plainly unsure how it should view the fact that it had fallen right in among us. "In those days, the company was in service to the Syndic of Beryl." I told them about another For Valaka, long ago and far away, and way more cruel than this one ever could be. I wanted them to worry. Chapter 7 An Abode of Ravens. Night Visitor. Lady and I sat up with One Eye. Gota had been laid out in the same room. Candles surrounded her. I see no obvious change in the woman.
"Croker, hush!"
"I hear a difference, though. She hasn't complained about anything since we got here." Playing deaf, One Eye took a long drink of his product, closed his eyes, nodded off. Lady whispered,
"It's probably best if he naps."
Not very lively bait.
Carrion's good enough to draw this thing. What it wants to kill really only exists inside itself. One eye is just its symbol. She rubbed her eyes. I winced. She looked so old, my love. Gray hair, wrinkles, jowls developing, broadening in the beam. The deterioration had been swift since Sleepy rescued us. Lucky for me, there was no mirror handy. I really do not like to look at that fat, old, bald guy who goes around claiming to be Croker. The shadows in the room were restless. They made me nervous. From the beginning of our association with Taglios, shadows have been cause for terror. A shadow in motion meant death could have hold of you any moment. Those sad but cruel monsters off the plane had been the lethal instruments by which the Shadow Masters had earned their fame and had enforced their wills. But here, in the land of unknown shadows, the hidden folk who lurked in the dark were shy, but not ordinarily unfriendly, if treated with respect. And even those manifestations owning a history of wickedness and malice now worshipped Tobo and harmed no mortal closely associated with the company, unless that mortal was dim enough to irk Tobo somehow. Tobo lived as much in the world of the hidden folk as he did in ours. In the distance, the spectral cat Big Ear again mouthed his unique call. Native legend says only the creature's prospective victims ever hear that chilling cry. A couple of the black hounds bayed. Legend suggests you do not want to hear their voices, either. Interviews with locals lead me to believe that before Tobo arrived, only ignorant peasants really believed in most such perils of the night and the wild. Educated folk at Kang Pi and Kuan Nin had been stunned by what the boy had summoned from the shadows. I glanced at the spear above the door. One Eye had worked on that for decades. It was as much a work of art as weapon. Hun, didn't One Eye start crafting that spear because of Bohawk? She paused in her knitting, stared up at the spear, mused. Seems to me Mergen wrote that One Eye intended to use it on one of the Shadow Masters, but ended up sticking Bohawk with it instead, during the siege. Or was that... My knees creaked as I rose. Whatever, just in case, I took the spear down. Damn, it's heavy. If the monster does get this far, try to keep in mind that we'd rather catch it than kill it. I know, it was my bright idea, the wisdom of which I had begun to doubt. I thought it might be interesting to see what would happen if we could force it to change back into the woman it had been before it had become fixed in its cat shape. I wanted to ask her questions about Katovar. Always assuming that the invader was the dread for Valaka, Lisa Dela Bohawk. I sat down again. Sleepy says she's ready to send spies and scouts across. We've been avoiding the facts a long time. This was hard. It had taken me an age to work up to it. The girl, our child. Boo Boo? You too? We have to call her something. The daughter of night is so unwieldy. Boo Boo works without being an emotional Calthrop. We have to make some decisions. She'll... Blackhounds, Catsith, Big Ears, and numerous other hidden folk began to give voice. I said, "That's inside the wall." "Headed this way," she set her knitting aside. One Eye's head rose. The door exploded inward before I finished turning to face it. A plank floated toward me in slow motion, slapped me across the belly hard enough to set me down on the floor on my butt. Something huge and black, with blazing angry eyes, followed the board, but lost interest in me in mid-leap. Still falling backward onto my back, I scored its flank with One Eye's spear. Flesh parted. Rib bones appeared. I tried to thrust on into the beast's belly, but did not have enough leverage. It screamed, but could not alter its momentum. Burning pain seared deep into my left shoulder, not 3 inches from the side of my neck. The Forvalaka was not responsible, though. Friendly fire was. My sweet wife had discharged a fireball projector while I was between her and her target. There was plenty of fire left, though, when that ball, its flight path altered, clipped the panther's tail 2 inches from its root. The monster's scream continued. It flung its head back while still airborne. Its whole frame was in the position heralds call rampant. It hit One Eye. The old man made no obvious effort to defend himself. His chair went over. It shattered into kindling wood. One Eye skidded along the dirt floor. The Forvalaka plowed into Gota, tipping the table on which she had been laid out. Lady loosed another fireball. It missed. I fought to get around onto my hands and knees, then to get the head of the spear up between me and the monster. It fought for its footing while trying to turn at the same time. It slammed into the far wall. I got my feet under me, started to stumble around. Lady missed again. No! I shrieked. My feet tangled. I came close to landing on my face again. I tried to do 3 things at once, and naturally did none of them well. I wanted to get hold of One Eye. I wanted to get my spearhead back up. I wanted to get the hell out of that house. Lady did not miss again, but this fireball was a puny one, a near dud. It hit the monster right between the eyes and just ricocheted off, taking a few square inches of skin along with it, leaving a patch of skull bone exposed. The Forvalaka screamed again. Then One Eye still blew up, which is what I had expected from the moment Lady's fireball had gone through the wall. Chapter 8 Taglios. Trouble follows. Mugabe knew there was trouble seconds after he left his rooms, so austerely furnished in shabby regrets. Palace staffers pushed to the sides of the corridors as he passed. Without exception, they were scuttling away from the Privy Council chamber. They must have heard rumors that had not yet reached his ears. Rumors they were sure would displease the Protector, which meant that soon someone would be making life unpleasant for someone else, and these people hoped to be well out of the way before he started. Pride, he said in a normal, conversational voice to a young gray runner trying to ease past without attracting notice. Pride is what did me in. Yes, sir. Color drained from the young Shadar's face. He did not yet have a beard to hide behind. I mean, no, sir. I'm sorry. Mugabe was gone, indifferent to the apprentice soldier. Similar incidents occurred each time he passed through the palace. He spoke to almost everyone. Those who had watched the habit develop understood that he was talking to himself and did not expect any reply. He was pursuing a running debate with his own guilts and ghosts, unless he was spouting proverbs and aphorisms, most of the meanings fairly obvious, but a few convolute and obscure. He was particularly fond of fortune smiles and then betrays. He just could not get into bed comfortably with the truth that he had made that bed himself. He still had difficulty separating ought to be from the way things really are. He was no fool, though. He knew he had problems. He was certain that he had a much more solid grip on reality than did his employer, though. Soulcatcher, however, took the view that she was a virtual free agent and refused to be wedded to any particular reality. She believed in creating her own by making her imaginings come true. Some were quite mad. Few, however, lasted beyond the heated moment of conception. Mugabe heard crows arguing ahead. Crows infested the palace these days. Soulcatcher was fond of crows. She allowed no one to harass or harm them. Of late, bats had made a claim on her affections as well. When the crows became vocal, the few servants still around started moving much faster. Unhappy crows meant unhappy news. Unhappy news was guaranteed to produce an extremely unhappy protector. When Soulcatcher was unhappy, she did not care who suffered the consequences, but someone surely would. Mugabe stepped into the council chamber and waited. She would talk to him when she was ready. Gopal Singh of the Greys and Aridatha Singh of the City Battalions, no relation, Singh was the most common surname in Taglios,
were there already, which meant that Soulcatcher must have been haranguing them about their failure to root out enough enemies again before the bad news arrived. Mugabe exchanged glances with both men. As he believed himself to be, they were good men trapped by impossible circumstances. Gopal had a flair for enforcing the law. Aridatha was equally talented at keeping the peace without enraging the populace. Both men managed despite Soulcatcher, who loved both chaos and despotism, and inflicted each with verve and ferocity, driven by the dictates of whimsy. The woman seemed to materialize suddenly. It was a talent she used to disconcert lesser beings. A lesser man than Mugabe might have been numbed by the sight of her. The woman had a body the wonders of which seemed highlighted rather than concealed by the tight black leather she wore. Nature had blessed her with superb raw materials. Her vanity had driven her, over the centuries, to keep making improvements through cosmetic sorceries.
"I'm not happy," Soulcatcher announced. Her voice was petulant, that of a spoiled child.
Today her look was younger than usual, as though she wanted to spark every young man's fantasy. Although the preening crow on the tall chair back behind her was a distraction once she settled.
"May I ask why?" Mugabe asked.
His voice was calm, untroubled. Life in the palace at Taglios consisted of a disorganized stumble from crisis to crisis. He no longer became emotionally involved. Soulcatcher would turn on him someday. He had made his peace with that already. He would face it calmly when it came. He deserved no better.
"There is a huge deceiver festival being celebrated in the Grove of Doom. Right now. Tonight."
This voice was cool, calm, rational, masculine. You got used to the changes after a while. Mugabe seldom noticed anymore. Aridatha Singh, only recently promoted, still found the unpredictable chorus disconcerting. Singh was a sound officer and good soldier. Mugabe hoped he lasted long enough to become accustomed to the protector's quirks. Aridatha deserved better than he was likely to get.
"That's definitely not good news," Mugabe agreed. "Seems I recall you wanting to harvest the timber there while obliterating every last trace of the holy place. Selvas Gupta talked you out of it, said it would set a bad precedent."
Gupta had had secret encouragement from the great general, who had not cared to waste manpower and time clearing a forest. But Mugabe loathed Selvas Gupta and his smugly holy attitude of superiority. Gupta was the current Purohita, or official court chaplain and religious advisor. Purohita was a post that had been forced upon the Radishadra 20 years earlier by the priesthood at a time when the princess had been too weak to defy them. Soulcatcher had not yet abolished it, but she had little patience with the men who occupied it. Selvas Gupta had been Purohita for a year, which incumbency exceeded that of all his predecessors since the establishment of the protectorate. Mugabe was confident that slimy little snake Gupta would not last out the week. Soulcatcher gave him a look which offered the impression that she was peering deep inside him, sorting his secrets and motives. Having paused just long enough to suggest that she was not being fooled, she said,
"Get me a new Purohita. Kill the old one if he argues about it."
She had an ancient custom of being unpleasant toward priests who disappointed her, which ran in the family. Her sister had slain hundreds in a single massacre a generation earlier. The exemplary demonstrations of both sisters, however, never seemed sufficient to convince the survivors that they ought to abandon their scheming. They were stubborn.
It seemed likely that Taglios would come up short of priests before it ran short of conspiracies.
The crow hopped down onto Soulcatcher's shoulder. She lifted gloved fingers to offer it some tidbit.
"Did you have a response in mind? Something involving my colleagues?"
Mugabe nodded toward the Singhs in turn. He suffered little jealousy of either man, and did respect each for his abilities. Time and persistent adversity had ground the rough edges off of his once potent sense of self-appreciation.
"These gentlemen were here already, regarding another matter, when the news from the grove arrived."
She offered the crow another morsel. Mogaba's eyes narrowed the tiniest fraction. He was not to be made privy to that matter. But he was. Soulcatcher used a cackling crone's voice.
"The Greys found several slogans painted on walls today."
The crow cawed. Elsewhere, other crows began squabbling. "Not uncommon," Mogaba replied. "Every idiot with a brush, a pot of paint, and enough education to string 5 characters together seems to be compelled to say something if he discovers a blank piece of wall." "These were slogans from the past." This was the voice the Protector used when she was focused entirely on business. It was a male voice, a voice like Mogaba imagined his own to be. "3 said Raja Dharma. I've heard the Bodhi cult is making a comeback, too." Gopal Singh added, 2 said, "Water sleeps. That's not Bodhi, and they weren't stray graffiti left over from 4 years ago." A thrill, half fear, half excitement, coursed through Mogaba. He stared at the Protector. She said, "I want to know who's doing it. I want to know why they've decided to do it right now." Mogaba thought both Singhs looked cautiously pleased, as though glad to have potential real enemies to chase instead of just irritating people who would otherwise remain indifferent to the palace. The Grove of Doom was outside the city. Everything outside was Mogaba's province. He asked, "Was there some particular action you wished me to take in regard to the deceivers?" Soulcatcher smiled. When she did that, just that way, every minute of her many centuries shone through. "Nothing. Not a thing. They're scattering already. I'll let you know when. It'll be when they're not ready." This voice was cold, but filled with her evil smile. Mogaba wondered if the Singhs knew how seldom anyone saw the Protector without her mask. It meant that she meant to involve them in her schemes too deeply for them to escape the association. Mogaba nodded like a dutiful servant. It was all a game to the Protector, or possibly several games. Maybe making a game of it was how you survived spiritually in a world where everyone else was ephemeral. Soulcatcher said,
"I want you to help catch rats. There's a shortage of carrion. My babies are going hungry."
She offered her black-winged spy another treat. This one suspiciously resembled a human eyeball. Chapter 9. An Abode of Ravens. The Invalid. Am I still alive? I did not need to ask. I was. Pain was a dead giveaway. Every square inch of me hurt. "Don't move." That was Tobo. "Or you'll wish you hadn't." I already wished I did not have to breathe. "Burns?" "Lots of burns. Lots of banging around, too." Mergen's voice said, "You look like they whipped your ass with a 40-pound ugly stick, then slow-roasted what was left over an open pit." "I thought you were at Kang Pi." "We came home." Tobo said, "We kept you unconscious for 4 days." "How is Lady?" Mergen told me. "She's in the other bed, in a lot better shape than you." "She ought to be. I didn't shoot her." "The cat get her tongue?" "She's asleep." "What about One Eye?" Tobo's response was barely audible. "One Eye didn't make it, Croaker." After a while, Mergen asked, "You all right?" "He was the last."
"Last? Last what?"
"The last one who was here when I joined the company. I was the real old man now."
"What happened to his spear? I've got to have his spear in order to finish this."
"What spear?" Mergen asked. Tobo knew what spear.
I have it at my place.
Was it damaged by the fire?
Not much. Why?
I'm going to kill that thing, like we should have a long time ago. You don't let that spear out of your sight. I've got to have it. But right now, I'm going to sleep for a while some more.
I had to go where the pain was not, just for a time. I had known One Eye would leave us someday. I thought I was ready for that. I was wrong.
His passing meant more than just the end of an old friend. It marked the end of an age. Tobo said something about the spear. I did not catch it, and the darkness came back before I remembered to ask what had become of the Forbalaka. If Lady had caught or killed it, I had gotten myself worked up for nothing. But I guess I knew it could not be that easy. There were dreams. I remembered everyone who had gone before me. I remembered the places and times. Cold places, hot places, weird places. Always stressful times, swollen with unhappiness, pain, and fear. Some died, some did not. It makes no sense when you try to figure it out. Soldiers live and wonder why. Oh, it's a soldier's life for me. Oh, the adventure and glory. It took me longer to recuperate than it had that time I almost got killed outside De Jagere. Even with Tobo applying his own best healing spells, learned from One Eye, and urging his Edge of the Eye friends to help as well. Some of those were supposed to be able to bring a fossil back to life. I felt like a fossil, like I had not enjoyed the advantage of the stasis that had frozen the others while we were prisoners under the plane. There was a lot of confusion inside me. I could no longer figure out how old I am. My best guess is 56, give or take a few years, plus all that time underneath the earth. And 56 years, brother, was a pretty damned good run, particularly for a guy in my racket. I ought to appreciate every second, including all the misery. Soldiers live, and wonder why. Chapter 10 An Abode of Ravens. Recovery. 2 months had passed. I felt 10 years older, but I was up and around, and moving like a zombie. I had indeed been roasted well done by a jet of almost pure alcohol blowing through the hole that had been drilled by Lady's errant fireball. Everybody kept telling me how much the gods must love me, that I had no business being alive. That had I not been turned the way I was, with the Forvalaka positioned perfectly to absorb a lot of the blast, there would not have been much left of me but bones. I was not entirely convinced that that might not have been the better outcome. Persistent pain does little to buoy one's optimism or elevate one's mood. I began to develop a certain sympathy for Mother Gota's perspective. I did manage a smile when Lady began to rub me down with healing unguents. Silver linings, she told me.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Would you look at that? Maybe you're not as old as you think.
It's all your fault, wench.
Sleepy's worried about you wanting to avenge One Eye.
I know. I did not have to be told.
I had had to put up with people like me when I was captain.
Maybe you should tone it down.
It's got to be done. It's going to be done. Sleepy's got to understand that. Sleepy is all business. Her world does not include much leeway for emotional indulgence. She thinks I just want to use One Eye's death as an excuse to visit the Katovar Shadowgate, basing her judgment on the fact that I had tramped through hell for a decade trying to get to that place. The woman is hard to fool, but she can also get fixed on one idea to the exclusion of other possibilities.
She doesn't want to make any more enemies.
More? We don't have any. Not out here. They may not like us much, but they all kiss our asses. They're scared to death of us.
And they get more scared every time another white lady or blue man or Victlin or whatnot lumbers out of folklore and joins Tobo's entourage.
Is that the spot? I saw something Tobo called a wowsie with the black hounds yesterday.
That is my honey. She can see those things clearly, even over here.
It's as big as a hippo, but looks like a beetle with a lizard's head. A lizard with big teeth. To quote Swan, it looks like it fell out of the ugly tree and hit every single branch on the way down.
Willow Swan seemed to be cultivating a new image as a churlish but colorful old man. Somebody has to step in and take One Eye's place, though I was sort of thinking about picking up the stick myself.
What do we know about the Forvalaka? I asked.
I had avoided asking for specifics before. I knew the damned thing got away. That was all I needed to know until I was prepared mentally to start planning the conclusion of its tale.
It left its tail behind. It suffered severe burns and several deep wounds, and I blinded it, partially, with my last fireball. It lost several teeth. Tobo has created a number of fetishes using those and bits of flesh torn off by the black hounds while it was fleeing toward the Shadow Gate.
But it did have what it takes to get back to Katovar.
It did.
Then it's going to be as hard to kill as the Limper was.
Not anymore. Not with what Tobo has.
He had your help.
I'm ancient in the ways of wickedness, am I not? Didn't you write something like that a time or two?
Especially after I got to know you.
Ouch!
Well, as long as you're a bad girl like you're being a bad girl right now. I do not recall if I did write the exact words she claimed, but I know I recorded those approximate sentiments many years ago, without exaggerating. I'm going to go after it.
I know.
She did not argue. They were humoring me. They wanted to keep me quiet. Sleepy was involved in touchy negotiations with the File of Nine. The Court of All Seasons and the Monks of Kangpi were behind us already. The warlords of the File remained unconvinced that it would be wise to give us what we want, even though the company has grown to the point where it has become a serious burden on Xian's economy, and poses a threat if the notion of conquest happens to take root. I myself do not see one warlord, or even a cabal of warlords out there, who would stand much more chance than smoke in a high wind if the notion did take us. Most of the warlords are clear on that, too. They still want Maricha Mantara Dumraksha, our Shadow Master Long Shadow, desperately. Their hunger for revenge borders on racial obsession. They are not forthcoming about the evils Long Shadow visited upon their forebears, but we have our sources inside Kangpi. Long Shadow's cruelties had been as capricious as any wickedness of soul catchers, but far more terrible for their victims. The need to haul the Shadow Master up before a tribunal colored every consideration of the warlords, the legal and noble courts, even the several spiritual traditions of Xian. Maricha Mantara Dumraksha was the one thing they all agreed upon. Nor did I ever sense a hint of a chance some rogue would try to acquire control of Long Shadow in an effort to amplify his own power. Sleepy did not want a short-tempered, foul-mouthed, but still influential former captain stumbling around, being sarcastic and opinionated, while she was trying to wring the one last concession she wanted out of the File of Nine. She was confident that our years of good behavior would tilt the scale, and if it did not, well, she was the kind of planner who always had a secondary scheme in motion. In fact, she was that wonderful kind of villain for whom the public and obvious scheme might well be only a tertiary effort meant primarily as a smokescreen. Our Sleepy was one wicked little girl. There are no great sorcerers in the land of unknown shadows. All evil dies there an endless death, means that they have persecuted the talented since the flight of the Shadow Masters. But Xian does not lack or disdain knowledge. There are several huge monasteries, of which Kangpi is the greatest, dedicated to the preservation of knowledge. The monks do not sort it into good and evil knowledge, nor do they make moral judgments. They take the position that no knowledge is evil until someone chooses to do evil with it. Even though it has been engineered to wreak havoc upon the human body, a sword is strictly inert metal until someone chooses to pick it up and strike, or chooses not to do so. There are, of course, a thousand sophistries spewed by those who wish to deny individuals the opportunity to choose, which is an arrogant presumption of a divine scale. This is what happens when you get old. You start thinking. Worse, you start telling everybody what you think. Sleepy was nervous lest I express an unfortunate opinion to one of the nine, whereupon, in high dudgeon, the offended party would abandon all sensibility and self-interest and deny to us forever the knowledge we need to repair the shadow gate opening on our native world. She misapprehends my ability to evoke the unfriendly response. Before the Werepanther came, I might have stumbled. I might have expressed an actual opinion to a member of the file, some of whom are amongst the most reprehensible generals I have ever encountered. I doubt that, given the opportunity to rule unchallenged, many of them would be more enlightened than the hated Shadow Masters. People are strange. The children of the dead are among the strangest. I will not upset anyone. I will be diligently supportive of any policy Sleepy sets. I want to leave this land of unknown shadows. I have things to accomplish before I hand these annals over for the last time. Settling up with Lisa Daly Bowalk is just one. There is the great general, Mogaba, the darkest traitor ever to stain the company's history. There is Narayan Singh. For Lady, there is Narayan and Soulcatcher. For both of us, there is our child, our wicked, wicked child. I asked, is there anything besides Long Shadow we could offer the File of Nine? Sweeten it just enough to make them move over beside Kang Pi and the Court of All Seasons. My sweetie shrugged.
I can't imagine what.
She smiled enigmatically.
But it may not matter.
I did not pay sufficient attention. Sometimes I overlook the new truths. These days my company is managed by sly children and devious old women, not straightforward stalwarts like myself and the men of my time.